Welcome to Take It From Us with host Kent Johns. Real people, real voices, real lives. Discussing mental health, addiction and disability in the community. Your weekly window to the real world. Welcome to Take It From Us.
Our guest on Take It From Us today is Liam Scopes. Liam comes from a high-performance background. He's a former elite triathlete and is now the Senior Manager of Strategic Wellbeing at Air New Zealand, supporting the health and wellbeing of staff at one of the biggest companies in Aotearoa. We discuss the role of managers in supporting people at work, the challenges of having senior leaders truly buying into workplace wellbeing, and ensuring companies do more than just tick boxes as far as promotion of best practice. You'll really enjoy Liam's enthusiasm on these topics and what he is hopeful for. Tell us about your job, about your role.
Yeah, I feel really fortunate. I've got this role of Senior Manager of Wellbeing at Air New Zealand, and I've been here 8 years now, sort of moved up through the team through that time, but always been in the wellbeing space. And I just feel super fortunate that with this big organisation who puts this huge focus on wellbeing, and that includes, you know, physical wellbeing, but also more recently lots around mental health and mental wellbeing. And so, yeah, we work right across the business just trying to support the wellbeing of individuals. So that's part of the role. But then also, you know, how we empower teams to be looking out for each other and looking after each other, lots of peer-to-peer sort of stuff, lots of work with managers and leaders to help them understand. And our focus now has really shifted to sort of trying to understand root cause of poor mental health, or actually what in the workplace can we do to make it a better environment to support, you know, people who are doing really well so they can keep thriving, but also those who might be struggling. What are we doing to just make sure at the very least we're not making it tougher for them?
But what have you learned so far about that?
What I've learned is it's a really difficult space. We sort of have this framework. We call it the me, we, us framework. So like I say, we're trying to do lots around the individual at the me level. The us level is that sort of peer-to-peer and leadership space. The us piece is a really difficult one. It's where we make the real step change. But it's a tricky stuff. But also, we often call it the pebble in the shoe. So, you know, what are some little just niggly things that every day someone comes up and has to overcome that little thing? And it might only be little, but if it's constantly there nagging away, it's going to impede them. So often, what is it? It's lots around sort of training and induction and just really understanding what your role is, role clarity and control over your role. We know that leadership plays a big part of it. So it's sort of, we're really digging into it now. There's often lots of just simple things which make a big difference. And that's sort of where we're trying to, focus our efforts now.
It's interesting you talk about the role of leadership, and also, which I guess comes back to culture, but also clearly having defined roles. So those are preventative for, say, burnout if people have the clarity. Has that come up as a real issue? Burnout for people at work?
It has, yeah, and I know it's the burnout's, real personal thing and how you interpret it. But, you know, across, you know, Aotearoa, but certainly in New Zealand, it's been a blimmin' tough time, and it continues to be. We've got all these supply chain issues now, and it's really difficult for our people. We always say in New Zealand's great in a crisis. Everyone jumps to the grindstone and does their thing. Normally the crisis is a bit more short-lived, and we come out the other end and everyone takes a breath. But honestly, you know, even leading into COVID, you know, remember there's like fuel pipeline and that sort of thing, then engine issues, then COVID. Now coming out of that, we had to revamp, you know, the airline, get lots of people back into it. So yeah, people are definitely feeling the pinch of that. You know, it's a tough time to be just sort of grinding away. And so lots of our work with leaders in particular is just to help, and individuals, help them think about, okay, how can I reset to, you know, this isn't the new normal. Let's bring it back to that ability to go hard when we have to, but then also take a breath when we can. That's difficult. And in honesty, often it's the leaders who are at the most risk of burnout, because they're trying to get involved and train new people and fill in the gaps, but also, you know, meet expectations and manage people and manage up to, you know, senior leaders and things too. So we've definitely identified that it's our frontline leaders in particular who are, you know, at really high risk of struggling.
Yeah, well, through COVID, I think besides health professionals, managers were second most likely as a profession or an occupation to experience burnout. And I guess for senior leaders, they're taking on a lot of the stress and the worry and the fear from the people that they are leading. So they're having to manage it themselves, but also it's tough. I mean, I talk to a lot of leaders. I coach a few myself, and most of them will tell me that having to list, just the listening and being there for others can be exhausting. And so I guess that's a focus for you, where you're having to help provide tools and some expertise around actually managing other people, but also their own expectations on themselves?
100%, yeah. And often, you know, if you're a good leader, you're probably trying to protect your team a little bit and buffer them from some of the turmoil that's going on. And so you're right, that's a really heavy sort of load to carry. And so lots of the stuff we try and do with leaders is, you know, first of all, some self-care. Actually, you know, as we know, it's the oxygen mask analogy. Take some time to look after yourself. And we did some interesting research a few years ago with AUT in the Human Potential Centre around sort of leadership behaviours and what that looks like. And we found one of the really strong behaviours that led to good well-being of your team was role modelling, good well-being. And so that's sort of our backdoor entrance. You know, if you don't want to do it for yourself, at least do it for your team. So if you take some time to look after yourself and, you know, take some breaks or switch off when you can, or just sort of keep things manageable, then obviously it's going to look after yourself, but your team are going to see that too and empower that as well.
Well, it's that halo effect, isn't it, where you might look at your leader and go, man, he's telling us to take days off when we're not feeling well. He's telling us to stay at home when we need to. He's telling us to make sure that we are there for our children and don't become consumed by the job, and to have short breaks and to make sure that we're going for little walks. But he never does it himself. So people 100%. Pick up on it, don't they?
They absolutely do. And so exactly that. If I'm telling you to do all the stuff but I'm not doing it, chances are I'm going to feel bad when I do it. So, you know, so we talk to, it's just that role modeling piece, talk to the leaders about, hey, just if you're going to pick your kids up from school, or you're going to take a break, or, you know, go and sit away from your desk, do they have lunch or whatever it is, just be overt about that, you know, because I love the concept of leaders leaving loudly. You know, if you're leaving early to go and do something, go to swimming lessons, actually make a big noise about that so everyone sees it's okay to do. We've got the challenge too, being, you know, obviously a 24-hour international operation where, you know, many leaders feel like they have to be on a lot of the time, and so really trying to balance that with them too is a difficult one.
Well, I think your workforce is 10,000 people plus?
12,000 now.
12,000 yes. People all scattered all over the place, and it's easier to be wedded to our jobs and our work. How are you able to communicate to people that whilst we value that attitude, it may not necessarily be healthy all of the time?
Yeah, for sure. So when we're spending time with leaders, we just try and really hammer home. It's a bit of peak performance stuff. You know, what does an athlete do to achieve peak performance? They train blimmin' hard and do lots of really difficult work and tough work, but then they recover from it. They step away from it and they, you know, refuel and rest and rejuvenate and all that sort of thing. And that's what, you know, if you want to be a high-performing leader, for example, or, you know, employee, that's what you should do. Go hard, you know, focus, do good work, but then step away from it very regularly as well, so that your body can recover and then you can come back fresh to tackle problems as well. So, you know, we talk about that being just on, you know, in a normal day or a normal shift, you know, micro pauses and breaks throughout that so you can reset at the end of each day, switching off. I love the concept of serious leisure, you know, having some stuff you do away from work that you love doing, it challenges you and you spend time doing that because it completely helps you switch off. And then the longer term recovery too, you know, extended days off and holidays and all that sort of thing. So trying to really embed that in the understanding of leaders. If I go hard all the time, that's not high performance. Picking up and then dropping back, that's what high performance looks like.
And you're leading into the growth mindset there about self-development and self-care. And look, I know this firsthand, that there is often resistance to that from very successful people because they're all or nothing characters. Do you meet that sort of resistance when you're explaining this philosophy to others?
Yeah, absolutely. And it is really difficult. And, you know, many of our, you know, think about our exec, they're really high performing people who are, you know, seem to be always on and always doing their thing. And so it can be difficult, and particularly, you know, if you're striving for sort of aspirationally those sort of roles, it's difficult to see that. So, yeah, as much as possible, we try and bring a bit of science and evidence into it and use those analogies, you know, that athlete analogy. And the one I often like using is Lionel Messi, you know, spends, you know, 85% of the time walking on the soccer field.
Walking.
Yeah, but then jumps up and performs at his best when he needs to. And just because he's walking, it means he's not a waste of space. He's analysing, he's thinking, he's strategising, and then is able to peak up. And so trying to use analogies like that for people to sort of see the benefit.
Yeah, and I mean, you're a high-performance athlete yourself, so you've got that background. How have you found transitioning from your former career and your former life into one where you're working with this massive big corporate entity, this big moving beast, and taking all of your knowledge, but having to apply it in a completely different setting.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's certainly been interesting and been a cool journey. And again, I think it's back to that sort of high performance, you know, whether myself trying to make it as a professional triathlete or coaching other people too. Again, it's actually just having a bit of a plan, some structure, knowing what you're there to do on that day, doing that, and then actually when you're away from it, being happy to step away from it, recover and that sort of thing too. So, I guess that's how I've tried to use it, just really those analogies and just what I've learnt from, you know, trying to, as I say, be a high-performance athlete myself and use those strategies.
Well-being is such a it's an overarching concept. And I make the point often that, hey, when we're talking about well-being, we're really talking about health, because it's hard to achieve well-being if we're not healthy. And look, I see this, time and time again, where our own health, people in being engaged in their health and well-being, it just plummets to the bottom. And people are not looking after themselves. So then we have Mental Health Awareness Week in New Zealand. We have all these other little things. And I know that a lot of organisations, and some people have actually candidly told me that they believe that their company really sees well-being as a box-ticking exercise. It's something we need to do. We have to do something. Let's get one or two speakers in for this week, and then, hey, we've done it. How do you guard against that being a box-ticking exercise where you can actually embed it to be a cultural value at an organisation?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and pretty timely with Mental Health Awareness Week being just a couple of weeks ago. And honestly, like, we do a promotion of it and sort of make sure people are aware of our stuff, but we don't go overboard on it, because exactly that, we believe, you know, we focus on mental health and well-being, you know, every day throughout the year. Interestingly, when we started up our wellbeing team, when I started 8 years ago, our first campaign was no more green smoothies, trying to really shift that perception of wellbeing being, you know, fruit bowls and green smoothies and yoga, which for some people absolutely is, you know, that's part of their self-care, but that's not what we're here to do. What we're here to do is that underlying stuff. So again, making sure there's great resources that you can access yourself, lots of training and embedding that. But more importantly, actually, getting down to that sort of root cause stuff now. I guess for us, the crunch came, you know, during COVID, when there were lots of redundancies and downsizing across the airline, and we lost sort of a third of our people. And I guess that was the make or break, actually. Do we really believe in well-being, or is it going to be one of those nice-to-haves that we're going to ditch? And it was completely the opposite, actually. You know, we were at the forefront, huge support from the exec and the leaders and the board to really be there for people. And support people. So we just try and be really visible with it. I think the concept, like the idea of systems, you know, I forgot the author of the book, but, you know, people don't rise to the level of their goals, they fall to the level of their systems. And so making sure that actually we just have things in place, so you don't need to do stuff for yourself to be boosting up your well-being. When you come in the door at work, there's just things there that are just at least making sure it's not harming you in any way.
I mean, if you go to work, let's think about this. If you go to work and you're coming home stressed and worried and burnt out most nights, that's the job making you sick. That's the kind of confronting, if you look at it through that kind of prism, eh?
That's right, yeah. And of course there's going to be days where there's high stress or a project's due or there's been some big disrupt and that's going to stress you out and bring on all those sort of symptoms and things. But if that's happening day in, day out, then obviously, that's not healthy. And so it's all around, addressing that, you know, taking a real health and safety approach to it and doing some hazard identification, then assessing the risk there, and then actually saying, if we have people that, they're completely under-resourced and don't have the training to do the job they're doing, then that's going to be stressing them out and burning out, leading to work overload for other people. So let's address that. Let's, rather than just trying to run some well-being resilience sessions for that individual, let's think about why they might be feeling that way and think what we can change. Is it the way the work flows there? Is it actually the induction and training and recruitment process isn't doing its job, so we need to tweak that? Just trying to really understand what's happening underneath to be leading to those outcomes.
How big an issue is workload?
Yeah, it's definitely, definitely an issue. It's an interesting one because, you know, we're designed to deal with stress and pressure. We need a bit more work than we probably can do to be there, to get us achieving really well. But it's that balance. And so it's making sure I'm equipped to be able to deal with that workload. So again, it's just stuff like I've got real good role clarity. I know what I'm meant to do. I've got the skills to do it. I've got some autonomy and control that I can sort of design the work myself so that I can get the best out of it. I've got good support, got good leadership. So it's all those things which allow me to achieve big workload, but also actually if I don't have those things, then that workload is just going to compound and that's going to lead to that sort of mental distress or burnout as well. So it's a real sort of a fine balance and again, identifying what might be leading to it.
Yeah, it's interesting that you talked about the stress there because we do need it, right? We need acute stress and hormetic stress. Yep. And it's nice to hear that you talk about the workload, but like if you've got a challenging workload, that's cool, but it's when it's too much repeatedly. And then I guess on top of all of that, if you're not actually looking after yourself, you don't have the coping mechanisms to deal with the stress that is coming your way. And we're all in control over how we look after ourselves. How are you able to stress that point? And is that something that you're just constantly having to drill into people, or at least to get them thinking about it?
Yeah, I think it's that awareness, and that's, you know, no matter whether we're talking to a group of pilots or engineers or someone from the contact center or, you know, airport staff, it's exactly that. It's understanding, yeah, we need some stress in our lives and sort of to get up to that peak performance, but the awareness piece is the key. So actually, you know, when I get out of bed today for my shift or whatever it is, how am I doing? Or midway through that shift, actually, how am I doing right now? Am I struggling a bit? Am I feeling pretty energized because of good, tough work I'm involved in? Am I a bit flat? Because that self-awareness is the first thing, because actually once I know that, then I know what I might need to help get me through or keep me there. So that's a lot of what we talk about, actually, awareness of where you're at, and then having that kite or that sort of toolbox of things you do, you know, what's my go-to stuff that actually helps me in the moment, you know, and it may be just some deep breathing or having a chatting to someone. What do I do when I get home from the shift? What's going to help me recover or rejuvenate or completely bounce back? So yeah, just lots of awareness, but it's constantly reminding people of that too, because inevitably when you're under that distress or stress, you forget, all that goes out the window, right? That's the way our brain's wired, and we sort of forget those things. So it's trying to just hardwire it in as much as possible.
Oh, the number of times I've kind of mentally lost it and then thought, oh man, why don't you just do some deep breaths?
Yep.
But it's that gap between the feeling and the action is where the growth comes in, right? Or where the knowledge is, hey, if I just take my time. But of course it's easy to go blow past that and go into catastrophization.
Absolutely.
You see a bit of that? You see people lose their stuff just out of nowhere? Oh,
yeah, for sure. And that's exactly it. That's that stress response, the way we're wired up. You know, evolution's done a great job for us, and that's the way our brain works. When we feel a bit of distress, whether it's real or perceived, then straight away, you know, well, not straight away, we've got, like you said, there's that fraction of a moment before we jump into it, but then we dive into that emotional state, that sort of pessimistic state, and that real tunnel vision. And so, again, it's just helping people recognize that. And importantly, too, helping people recognize that others might be in that state, because again, when you're in there, your thinking's a bit impaired and it might take a while for you to recognize it. So lots of our stuff is just for, you know, teammates to recognize, hey, actually, you know, seems like you're, you know, a bit agitated or whatever it might be, and open up that conversation or just recognize it in others, because we know, you know, if you're suffering from some poor mental health or fatigue or something like that, actually you probably won't recognize it, but others probably will.
Yeah, well, the research says that, doesn't it? A lot of people that are really struggling don't identify with being close to burnout or beyond, yet their answers would say, hell yes, you're in real trouble here.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's just the way the brain works, that sort of protects us from it and gets us focusing on that, you know, life or death situation in front of us. And so again, it just comes down to leaders and peers then to be looking out and recognising that stuff and sort of being brave enough to have the conversation and just help that person through it.
Which I guess can bring us to loneliness. How does Air New Zealand best guard against that, the feeling of isolation and loneliness for people that may work remotely or they don't, for whatever reason, aren't as engaged with their team members as would be ideal?
Yeah, good question. I guess it's not something we specifically target, that loneliness piece. We do a lot of work around actually, you know, the importance of connection and having those connections inside and outside of work. Probably, you know, as you can imagine, for our air crew, be it pilots or cabin crew, when they're offshore and we call it a tour of duty, a TOD, when they're away for a night or so in a hotel somewhere. Generally, they'll try and come together, but often they you know, can be sort of isolated a bit there. So again, just really getting to think that awareness. Okay, well, how will I recognise if I'm struggling a little bit? Sometimes if you've just done a busy LA flight, it's been 12 or 13 hours, you just want some quiet time and go to Sydney Hotel by yourself and watch a bit of Netflix and eat a takeaway or something. That's really important. But again, it's just recognising, is this good for me? Is this going to help me right now? Or actually, am I better to try and connect in with someone and get some chat through a situation or discuss something?
You've been with the company now 8 years. When it comes to the discussion of mental well-being and mental health, what have you noticed about the changes in that discourse over an eight-year period?
Yeah, I feel pretty proud about where we've got stuff. We've certainly moved it along. It's front of mind for a lot of people. Most of our leaders are pretty engaged with it, and we're running a whole bunch of sort of mental health and sessions, currently, and then many leaders from across the business are coming along to them as well as sort of frontline leaders and employees. So I think it's something people are sort of seeing. It's just sort of part of the way we do things in New Zealand. It's something we talk about. A challenge for us is for pilots. For them, it's historically been a really difficult thing to sort of disclose and talk about mental illness or mental ill health. And so we've tried to really unpack that with them, try and break away some of that stigma. Most of it's associated or tied up with their license. And so actually the fear is that if I mention that I'm struggling a little bit, suddenly my license has been suspended. And historically that has sometimes been the case. But we've worked really closely with the Civil Aviation Authority and their chief medical officer to really help pilots understand if I went and disclosed such and such to my medical examiner, this is actually what would happen. But actually discuss it, make sure I've got some good support in place. It'll be a sort of a two-way conversation. So that's probably the most challenging. And rightly so, many pilots have been with the airline or in the field for a long time still feel some of that sort of hesitancy, but we're trying to slowly move that dial and give good examples of people who have raised things and got really good support and great outcomes.
Yeah, because I imagine too that if when it's not addressed, when they're pushing down, packing down the fear and the anxiety and the worry and whatever else, it's not going to be an adequate way to deal with it. It might feel like that in the short term. But so you're encouraging them, hey, look, if you actually just open up a little bit, it might actually, because I imagine a lot of them too would feel great for having had those conversations. Do they tell you that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think exactly that. Historically, it's been something like, don't mention it because I'll get my license suspended. Whereas actually, if the medical examiners will tell them this themselves, if we have this open discussion about, hey, my child's going through some stuff at school and, distracting me a little bit, then actually it's out of the open and we can talk about how to help you and get that good support. So definitely I think, we've got a really good EAP program as one of our support options, and it's really well utilised, including with pilots. And I think particularly males, which is, typically, majority of pilots are males. We're great to see some more females coming through, which is fantastic. But be it pilots or any sort of male across the industry, we know that if you spend a bit of time talking to someone, be it a professional or just a mate, actually that's hugely beneficial, because probably you don't naturally do that, whereas stereotypically, women more likely to have conversations and have friends that they debrief with, whereas males, that's typically not the case. So if we can get you to open up a little bit and talk, then that's hugely beneficial and potentially more beneficial than for females in some cases.
Right, and supporting people with depression, what's the best practice there?
Yeah, so again, it sort of depends on, it doesn't depend on the field they're in, but if you're a pilot, that's sort of handled in a slightly different way. But we're lucky we've got an in-house medical team, and so they can sort of give some guidance on that. I guess, a lot of our stuff is, depression is just, something on the mental health sort of continuum. It's something we all have. We've all got mental health. Some days it's really good. Some days it's really poor. And so if you've got depression, it's right now you're sitting at that end of the continuum. So let's think about what we can do to move you up there. We don't obviously diagnose that or work with them directly to overcome it or anything, but helping them, support them to get to the right support, or guide them to the right support, is certainly sort of where we come into it.
Yeah. How do managers find now being able to manage their team so that they are productive, that they're getting the job done, as well as being empathetic and totally understanding. So I could imagine that's a real challenge for managers to get that, to know what to do in certain situations.
Yeah, it can be really difficult. And I guess one of the really key things that comes down to is, and speak with managers about this, is just, you know your team. Actually spend time connecting with your team. You don't need to, you know, need to be best mates or anything like that, but just know what that person's like in good times, so you can recognise if they're struggling. I think that's the first piece. We know that, you know, often if someone's trying to hide something away and, you know, performance drops away, then eventually it comes to, you know, disciplinary or performance management type situation, often it ends up at the last minute, you know, actually, you know, I'm suffering from depression or some sort of disclosure about something going on. It's like, oh my gosh, if we could have just had this, you know, conversation out in the open really early on, it would have been such a better, you know, process and outcome for that person and get them the help they need really, really up front. So, yeah, for managers, recognising or knowing their people, recognising when they may be struggling, and then just being a little bit brave and having those conversations as well. You know, I think I haven't come from a sort of mental health background in terms of degrees or anything like that, and I think that's really good. I can, you know, say to people, actually, it's just a conversation. It's actually asking them. You don't need to solve the problem, but lots of listening, empathising, sort of normalising how they're feeling, and then just helping them guide themselves to what they might find useful to get through it.
Yeah, do people have the time and the energy these days to listen like that, do you find?
Probably not. And again, you know, as a busy manager trying to manage a big team, a new team, training, da-da-da, how do I find the time for that as well? So that is a big challenge. But I guess it comes down to actually, you know, short-term pain versus long-term gain. So actually if I take the time right now because I recognise you're struggling to just sit down, go for a wander, take an hour to really listen, that's going to be, you know, in the long term, much, much better than just trying to sort of push on and deal with things, you know, over the next few months.
Yeah, I think I read somewhere that ideally a manager would be engaging exactly how you're talking there at least once a week with every member of what would you call it, a direct report.
Yes,
people that they are responsible for managing. It can't just be every so often. It's got to be on a weekly basis. Hey, man, what's going on? He's still playing tennis. How's the family going? What do you got? Like, just being able to do that. But, of course, that's a skill in itself, eh? Do you think that we've got the managers in New Zealand that are adept at that?
Well, no, it definitely comes down to the individual a lot. And what we find, you know, and particularly in technical areas, historically what's happened is whoever was technically good at the job just, you know, moves through and becomes the manager. And maybe they don't want to be a people leader, or they haven't had the skills, or it's not sort of natural for them. So it is difficult. But again, just trying to remind people, it's actually really simple. It's just exactly that, just having a conversation. Like, hey, how's the family? You know, did you get away on that trip? How's your daughter? I know she was sick last week. Just trying to have that human connection with someone, I think that's really, really important. I talked about that role modelling before. What we also found in that research we did, that is, if my direct manager just shows some understanding of the pressure I'm under and acknowledges the hard work I'm doing, that goes a massive way to improving people's or maintaining people's good mental health. And so that's just what we try and tell our leaders, is they, all you need to do is, it's as simple as that, sit down, have a chat. Hey, I know it's been a blimmin' tough week. Thanks heaps. It's been really good. I know you did that project and you had a few late nights. Really appreciate that. You know, that's being a good leader. And it sounds super simple, but it is pretty profound.
It is, eh? And you know, I appreciate that too. Like, young kids just thrive in positive reinforcement and affirmation. Well, it turns out adults do too. Like, we all need it, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, and again, it just shows, oh, my leader sees me. They care about me. They want to ask a bit about my family or whatever and that. But also, yeah, they just recognise that I've been working really hard and doing some specific stuff and showing that thanks. So, yeah, I think sometimes people think being a leader can be a little bit scary and particularly around sort of mental health and wellbeing. So, again, what we just really try and do is remind them, hey, it's pretty simple. Just do some good role modelling yourself. Just connect with people. Thank them, acknowledge them, and if you're just doing those simple things, you're going to go a long way to having some really awesome outcomes.
It's good too to talk to someone in the aviation industry about the great metaphor of putting your own mask on first, because I throw that out there wherever I can, and it often lands well. Well, of course, how can I be in a strong position to care for and look after the people that I love if I'm not looking after myself? So how do you do that personally?
Yeah, nice question. I've got a few things I do. I sort of try and get out and run 4 or 5 times a week and sort of be active. That's a really key one for me. I've got 2 daughters who are 6 and 10, so I try and spend some good time with them and just muck around and have some fun, and obviously with my wife as well. What else? Reading is one of the things I really enjoy doing, so I try and just switch off at the end of each night with reading a novel or something like that. And I've got some great mates. I've spent a golf trip. I play indoor cricket once a week during the winter. I'm a big Warriors fan, so I've got season tickets there. So I've got a couple of things that just drag me out, and I'm inherently a bit of an introvert, and so without having those things, I probably wouldn't do them. And so just having, like I say, things that you have to be there for, to go and hang out with your mates and have a laugh as well, that's really important. So that's sort of what my toolbox looks like. I've got 4 or 5 things that I try and sort of do regularly, and don't always do them all, but have a few things, and my wife will kick me out for a run if I'm getting a bit grumpy or something, because she knows I need it.
I say she can pick up on the cue. Liam's a bit grumpy. Yeah. He needs to go and do something. I'm exactly the same. Why am I a bit tetchy today? I know why. I haven't moved. Haven't moved my body. Haven't moved my brain.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, when we were doing a wellbeing session, that's the first question we asked. What's your sort of secret sauce that you do for your wellbeing? What's the one most basic thing that makes you feel a bit better? And then also, when was the last time you did it? I think it's always just good to bring it front of mind, get people reminded. Actually, yeah, that's right. When I get in the garden and do a bit of gardening, or when I do some knitting, or go and tinker in the garage, or, get out and play football, actually, I do feel great. So, I should try and do that a little bit more.
Yeah, people often underrate those little things as being healthy, and they can stack up pretty quickly, man. You can do 5, 6, 8 little things a day for well-being that are really small and don't appear to be significant, but you stack that up over a week or over a few months.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I think particularly, as you become a parent or get busy and all that sort of thing, you feel a bit selfish sometimes doing those things, the bigger things. And so I think it's back to actually, I know, or remind yourself, but when you take that half an hour to go for a run or do whatever it is, you feel great when you come back and you're, a super much better partner probably, or manager or parent. And so just reminding that. But then also there's simple things too, in a busy, busy world, we often ask our people, okay, what's one or two things you could do, you've got control over, you can do it every day, it'll just make your day a bit better, and just identify that. When I get my coffee, I'm just going to sit down and take 2 minutes to drink that instead of rushing out the door, or I'm just going to make sure that, twice a day I just actually go and either look out the window or ideally get outside and have a wander around. Identifying those little stack up things which will definitely make a difference.
Let's finish on an optimistic note, Liam, because I can tell you're an upbeat, optimistic kind of a guy. If we're looking ahead, say, 5 years from now, what would you like to see different as far as workplace wellbeing goes?
Ooh, great question. I think I'm loving the work we're doing at the moment around, we call it psychosocial risk management, so the sort of the organisational factors at work which impact wellbeing. It's certainly, in Aussie, it's a big focus now. In New Zealand, it's becoming a bit of a focus. But in 5 years' time, I'd love that actually, it's just something everyone really understands and thinks about. So, if I'm looking after a team, I'm just super aware of all those different things that impact people's well-being. So I'm just, they have a really good understanding and awareness of those things: job control, role clarity, good interpersonal relationships, good supervisor support, people know what they're there to do, they've got purpose and meaning in their job. That's just all inherent, that actually, it's part of, almost in a job interview, that's sort of covered off, hey, this is what it looks like here. Really focusing on that root cause stuff, because I think once you nail that, then everyone's going to be lifted up to a great starting point, and that's when then you can come back in with all the nice stuff over the top to sort of really go for that peak performance piece.
Yeah. Hey, been great to chat, Liam. Appreciate your expertise and your experience, and thanks for sharing it with us today. Take It From Us is produced by Karen Murphy, and I am your host, Kent Johns. Please get in touch with us on Facebook. We'd love to hear from you.
You're listening to Take It From Us. My story, your story, our story. Yeah.
better than I ever knew myself. Yeah. You do things better when it's all for someone else. That's just you, and I trust you. But when I run down, leave a message. Pray I don't hear that, I'm leaving message. I'm in the studio, yo, don't need the stresses. I need you waiting at home to relieve the pressures. Instead you was out dancing, dancing, dancing. Yes, you was out dancing, dancing, dancing. I hope you was out dancing, dancing, dancing. And now with another man sing, man sing, man sing. I tried to text but you were dancing, dancing, dancing. With your girls and you're dancing, dancing, dancing. Hope you just drank you too much vodka, vodka, vodka. So you couldn't really answer, answer, answer. Hope you was out. You gave me the thrills when nobody else would. You would call just to chill when nobody else would. Cause they all got a gender. Like Riri, how you be seen? You give me that work. Then you feed me like a freebie. Your work come with perks. If you got a week free at the Fiji, know you feeling burnt. But you gotta get to your phone. But you were dancing, dancing, dancing. With your girls and you're dancing, dancing, dancing. Hope you just drank you too much vodka, vodka, vodka. So you couldn't really answer, answer, answer. Hope you was out. I'ma leave the key out just in case you make it to my flat. You know where to find me. Hope you ain't texting back just cause your phone battery gets flat. Knowing you was not likely, you just drank too much. I hope your friends can look up to you. I know you don't give too fuck about what they think, but girl, I'm asking you. Were you out dancing, dancing? Tell me you was out dancing, 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 yeah. Woo!
Et dans...